It's the summer of 2008, and Andre Kaplan is summoned by his older brother Dima to come immediately to Moscow and take care of their aging grandmother. Andre is 33, his girlfriend has just dumped him, and the only job he's been able to find since completing his PhD is teaching an online, poorly paid course. When Dima promises to buy him a round-trip ticket, get him into a hockey league, and give him his old bedroom with free Wi-Fi, Andre agrees. He hopes his grandmother will tell him stories of Soviet times on which he can base a scholarly article that will help him land a job in the States. He imagines himself protesting the Putin regime in the morning, playing hockey in the afternoon, and keeping his grandmother company in the evening. But his stay in Russia becomes something more than he bargained for. This is G.P. Gottlieb, host of New Books in Literature for the New Books Network, and I'm talking to Keith Gessen, founding editor of the brilliant literary magazine N+1, translator of several books and an oral history, and author of All the Sad Young Literary Men. Today we're discussing his new novel, A Terrible Country, about a young man who goes to take care of his ailing grandmother and learns a thing or two about life, about himself, the world, and much more. Hi, Keith, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. Very happy to be here.
Great. So could you start by talking a bit about yourself? Tell us what you're passionate about and how you came to write A Terrible Country.
Sure. I was born in Russia in what was then the Soviet Union. And my parents immigrated with me and my older sister in 1981 when I was six. And I grew up outside of Boston, and I grew up in a kind of, a kind of double world. It felt like my parents were sending me slightly mixed signals about Russia. On the one hand, it was a terrible place that we had left because people were mean to us. We should forget all about it. On the other hand, it was the source of all enlightenment and culture, all the books that my parents read and discussed and referenced. And, if there was a Russian movie showing in a movie theater, in downtown Boston or in Brookline, that was a big night out for us. On the one hand, they hated Russia as it then was, but they loved Russian culture and kind of were attached to Russia in all these ways. For kind of most of my childhood, I definitely took the first message to be the primary one, which was that we had left. And I say this in the book, I felt like we had, my parents had immigrated to America, but only to the Russia that existed inside of America. And that kind of the job for me and my sister would be to emigrate into America itself. And, I took that pretty seriously. A couple of things happened. One was that my mom died when I was in high school, toward the end of high school, before I became a senior. And then I went off to college, and kind of those two things happening in proximity to one another. My mom was the main sort of connection, culturally between us and Russia. She was a literary critic. She worked at the Russian Research Center at Harvard. Kind of losing that connection was something that I, felt very keenly. Then I got to Russia, I got to college, and it was a kind of big place. It was an intimidating place. There were a lot of people there who knew exactly what they were doing and what they were going to do with their lives, and I was less sure. So I ended up sort of kind of wandering into the Slavic department I have to say, since I'm on the New Books Network, my first teacher in the Slavic department was Marshall Poe, founder of the New Books Network, on which this podcast appears. So, yeah, I took a seminar with Marshall and Svetlana Boehm. It was in the history and literature department, and the way they would do it is they would have a historian and a literary scholar, teach, this kind of small seminar. And, Marshall, is this sort of big guy with a booming voice, very American, who worked on medieval Russian history. And Svetlana Boehm was a very elegant Russian Jewish emigre who worked on the, Russian and Soviet avant-garde. And, two very different people, two very different approaches, but both of them, really brilliant. And it was just incredibly intellectually stimulating, but also it was kind of personally, I just kind of felt like I belonged there. And then I started going over to Russia, I went over for my junior year abroad. And that was a very powerful experience. And it was kind of a personally powerful experience because so many of the things that had been weird or mysterious or embarrassing about my parents growing up, sort of became more comprehensible to me when I was over there, and kind of walking around the, places that they had grown up and spending time with their mothers who were still alive, my grandmothers. And also it was kind of a politically enlightening moment for me. I didn't have a strong kind of political view of the world. I was a young person at a kind of liberal arts university in the 1990s. So, I was kind of a liberal, but I had grown up in this very anti-Soviet household. And so I'd inherited a kind of skepticism of leftism and socialism. And I thought Americans who espoused it were naive. And then kind of going over to Russia in the mid 90s when it was falling apart, and where capitalism was really kind of running rampant and, allowed to do whatever it pleased and, in the process, destroy millions of lives. That was really eye opening for me. It took a little while, but I kind of, I began to question whether, capitalism was such a great thing. I began to wonder whether the so-called Russian transition was headed in the right direction, whether it was a good idea. Having human costs well beyond what was being, kind of discussed in the Western press, as far as I could tell. So that was kind of my background in Russia stuff. And so since then, I've been going over a fair amount, living there for periods of time, translating books, writing articles. And then in 2008, I had my first book had come out, and I was kind of a little bit at loose ends, and I had this opportunity to go over to Moscow and take care of my grandmother for a year. And I went and did that. It was a very intense experience. She was losing her memory. She was losing her hearing. She had lost the vast majority of her friends, either to immigration or to old age and death. Spending that year with her, it was very difficult. It was also very wonderful. And then at the end of it, I had to leave. When I got back, kind of while it was happening, I really didn't think of it as something that I was going to write about. It was, it was too difficult. It was too painful. I was too wrapped up in it. It wasn't really something that I was thinking about as kind of material for literature. But then I got home and I was like, oh, that was a really powerful experience that I would like to somehow get down on paper. So I started writing about it, and kind of the initial idea for the book was that it would be kind of description of this year spent with, that the narrator, kind of stand-in character for me, spends with his grandmother, but also a kind of denunciation of Russian capitalism. So it had these two goals these two things that it wanted to cover. And so for a while, it was kind of an unsuccessful, much too long combination of these two different books. And it took, it took an embarrassingly long time for me to figure out that actually, the grandmother's story, as I had, begun to increasingly sort of fictionalize it, that story actually made the case against Russian capitalism about as well as you could make it. And that, really the book needed to, have her at the kind of heart of it, and then, branch out as necessary or as possible into kind of other things.
Wow. There is so much here to talk about. So, and it really clears up a lot now that I understand that Andre is based on you. He was also six when his mother brought him and his brother to the States, although you had a sister. And he describes himself as basically Russian. Is that how you felt also?
I think at other points he describes himself as basically American.
Yes.
His feelings of homelessness or belonging to two places, sometimes belonging more to Russia and other times more to his adopted homeland of America. Yeah, that's certainly, that is my experience. Every time I go to Russia, I have this kind of dual experience of, on the one hand, feeling like, here's where I belong. Here's this food that I know and that I ate growing up. And here's the language that I spoke with my parents. And, they care about things that I care about, like Russian literature and history. The first experience of arriving in Russia is always kind of what is wrong with these people? Why do they do things like this? why is everything so inconvenient? Right. So I my first reaction was a very American reaction. And then after a little while, I kind of settle into the rhythm of life there. And I think, how could anyone live anywhere else?
Oh,
and it's hard to, everybody remarks on this. I don't really have an explanation for it, but, you do have a kind of intensity of relationships and experience there that, I have not had as much, in America. I think just the kind of day to day difficulty of doing stuff, just how hard life is there and how many people have had bad things happen to them. It does serve to kind of bring people closer together.
So when Andre first arrives in Moscow, his first thought while he's still at passport control was something about how he had no rights in Russia. Did you feel that way? Is that typical? What did he mean?
Oh, I mean, you just, well, he's not a citizen of Russia. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, the kind of first couple of chapters are, you know, he expects, you know, it's partly about how he expects to discover this police state. And, you know, he does, but it's, you know, it's quite a bit different from what he expected, right? Everybody's sitting around, you know, drinking expensive coffee. But in terms of rights, yeah, I mean, he kind of, in the most basic sense, doesn't have rights because he's not a citizen. But, you know, and the Russian state, even if he were a citizen, right, does not stand on legal ceremony with a lot of people. So, sure.
Yeah. So you had two grandmothers to visit, and Andrei's grandmother, Baba Sieva, is pretty complicated. He has a complicated relationship with her. She also has issues of dementia, as did your grandmother. And she has an interesting history as a translator, was it? Who led an active life before the dementia set in when she was about 90. Mm-hmm. And the part, I was really intrigued by the part how she kept on bringing up the loss of all her friends and the loss of her dacha. And how her dacha, best friend, yes. Dacha, and her best friend doesn't invite her. That goes throughout the book.
Right.
Did you come across something like that in your family?
A little bit. Yep. something like that. I mean, you know, all this stuff. Let me answer a slightly different question or a more general question. I mean, you know, there are different writers work different ways. I mean, I tend to, or at least with this material, I kind of started with what actually happened and then looked at it and said, you know, that's not interesting enough, or that doesn't, it's too disconnected from other stuff. I mean, one of the, you know, life is kind of, you know, over the course of a life, you have a kind of story, right, that emerges, but life is very long. And the kind of time frame of this novel is 1 year. So things had to make sense in the course of that year, if that makes sense what I'm saying.
I'm interested in the fact that she keeps talking about the dacha and how upset she is that she doesn't have it.
Yeah.
But how she got it in the first place, and how they got this fabulous apartment where Andrei is staying, and how they lost the dacha. That's pretty interesting and unusual, and says something about Russia.
Right. Okay. So that's not, are you asking if that's autobiographical?
No, you don't have to answer that.
Sure.
It's an interesting phenomenon.
Yes. And, right. So my grandmother, you know, received an apartment because her husband was in the Soviet Writers Union. So it's not quite as dramatic as in the book. But, you know, most people in the Soviet Union received their apartments from the state. I mean, that's how it worked. And so you had this, you know, depending on what your field of activity was, you got a better or worse apartment. And you might feel more or less kind of guilty about it. Certainly, you know, the grandmother in this book, like my grandmother, you know, hated the Soviet Union, right? So if you were going to set out to write a book about how someone in the kind of post-Soviet era was left behind, you know, if you were starting from scratch, you might pick a party member, right? And, you know, a true believer who had worked their whole life to build the Soviet dream, and then it all collapsed and fell apart, and now they're, you know, don't know what to do with themselves. You know, in the case of my grandmother, and I thought this was actually in a way more interesting. I mean, she hated the Soviet Union. She was very happy when it fell apart. it had deprived her of her only daughter, who emigrated to America. And yet she too, like this kind of true believing Communist Party member that we just imagined, I mean, she lost her life savings. She did not actually have a dacha to lose, but she, I think she lost her, in the sense of herself in the world. Certainly her, her husband's research institute fell apart. It was just, there was a kind of, economic toll that is really significant. There's a psychological toll too, even upon people who, against the Soviet Union and were happy that it no longer existed. That kind of image that I it comes up a fair amount in the book, and that really stuck with me from my time with her, is just kind of the image of this person who still lives in the center of Moscow, but is one of the only sort of people from that generation remaining. And she's kind of walking around through what is kind of remains of the Soviet Union. In her neighborhood, and she's like a ghost that is haunting sort of post-Soviet Moscow. That was very much the kind of impression that I got from my time with her.
Andrei is talks a lot about how the men in Moscow are all huge, kasha-fed, unsmiling, and the women are all beautiful and thin and wearing high heels, and how everyone is white. There's very little ethnic diversity. This was, the book was set in 2008. And have you been back since then? And is it still the same?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think of it as a kind of a graph. In terms of the Moscow's amenities versus sort of political freedoms, right? So if in the kind of mid-90s, mid to late-90s, when I started going over there, Moscow had no amenities, like literally no place to sit down and have a cup of coffee, zero places, but there were a lot of political freedoms, right? Since then, the kind of amenities have really increased, year on year, and continue to increase. And political freedoms have decreased, and continue to decrease. So, and 2008 is sort of in the middle of that, if you go from 98 to 2018, and 2008, is in the middle of that, both, in time wise, but also just kind of in the development of these processes. I was there, in this past winter, and I was shocked again, kind of shocked anew, as Andrei is shocked in the book, by how nice it was. Moscow is beautiful right now. They've knocked down a bunch of ugly stuff. They've opened more affordable cafes, the ruble has collapsed, so it's nice for a tourist. But political freedoms are kind of at their lowest point, so you come to Moscow and you see all these Russians kind of in a pretty good mood, certainly kind of when you're out in public, right? And everybody's just sitting and having a coffee. And in a way, if you don't turn on the TV, right, you can kind of live in this fantasy Moscow of kind of everything's great. And then as soon as you turn on the TV, it's, pretty, kind of state propaganda laying it on pretty thick.
Andrei is really, he's a kind of a sad sack. A little bit of a character, and his biggest challenge, he says, is finding Wi-Fi. And then he has this really funny experience trying to meet a woman, and one of them turns out to be a prostitute. I thought that was hysterical. based on reality?
I did have trouble getting Wi-Fi in my apartment.
Okay. That part of the question you answered. Okay. Let's talk about Andre's brother, Dima. He escaped to London when his attempt to expand his gas station business earned him some enemies. And then he's giving Andre errands to do. So it's sort of like he's putting his little brother in some kind of danger. What's going on there?
He's a kind of a mover and shaker and manipulator, and he is very much the kind of opposite of his younger brother, who is a bit of a loser, hasn't quite found his way in the world. Andre kind of starts out being very disapproving of Dima, the Dima character, I had thought of him as, we haven't got into it, but, the grandmother has this apartment in central Moscow that, as you alluded to, she got from Stalin. And Dima, who has run into legal trouble, wants her to sell the apartment. So partly so that he can pay his lawyers. And Andre is opposed to this. And that was in the book very early on. And I had always thought that I was basing it on the cherry orchard, where Lapachin, the businessman and friend of the family, wants them to, wants this old aristocratic family to chop down the cherry orchard and turn it into vacation rentals to save the family estate, right? Because they have no cash flow otherwise. I had always thought that Lapachin was evil, right? And a friend of mine who was reading kind of early chapters of the book, and who has a lot of experience in theater, Erica Rosenblum, he said, you should go and read The Cherry Orchard. It's not as you remember it. And I did. I read The Cherry Orchard. Didn't take very long. It turns out Lapachin actually is right. And he's actually trying to help the family. So that was a kind of critical point in the creation of the Dima character, where I kind of dialed it back a little bit and made the apartment decision a little more on the shoulders of Andre. So Dima emerged after my reading of The Cherry Orchard as a slightly more complicated character. I mean, he's someone who went over to Russia to try to make his fortune, but also kind of talked a lot, as these people did, about how he was actually building democracy, right? And capitalism and democracy go hand in hand. Andre questions whether that was the true motivation and whether Dima didn't actually want to just make some money. And, that's kind of unresolved. But within the family, Dima drives a hard bargain, but not necessarily a kind of demonic one.
No, and Andre loves him. The real bad guy in the book is his academic nemesis, Boris Fishman.
And
Alex Fishman. And Alex is more successful.
Is a contemporary writer. Yes.
Oops. Oh, you're right. Oops. I should have written that down. And Alex is more successful because he doesn't have the integrity that Andre has, right? Tell us more about that.
So Andre likes to think.
So he likes to think.
Fishman is a guy who's always talking about totalitarianism and Russia's eternal kind of totalitarianism. He's into the digital humanities. as they're called these days, as the internet is known now on campus. So, you know, he's just this guy. He's good at getting grants. He's a real networker. He goes to all the events. You know, then he, you know, if a professor comes to speak at their, a kind of a well-known, you know, professor comes to speak at their graduate program, Fishman will then go and write a blog post about how wonderful this professor is, you know, as a way of sort of kissing up. Yeah, that's an interesting character because, you know, to some extent, you know, these characters are kind of based, you know, some of them are based on real people, certainly the grandmother and Andres, you know, sort of based on me. Fishman is a made up character, start to finish. But, a lot of people have come up to me and said, oh, I know who Fishman is.
Oh,
yes. So I've learned what a lot of people think of, you know, X and Y and Z, mm-hmm. and various people who they think are the inspiration for Fishman. But so that's very funny, actually.
And then we need to talk about Yulia and, oh, Yulia and the connection, how she brings Andre into the October group.
Right. So Andre, you know, he spends, the first, you know, third or half of the book being kind of confused, depressed, can't really, he's not doing a great job of taking care of his grandmother. He had hoped to, find a kind of a topic for his academic, article, in Moscow, and he has failed to do that. Can't get a date, as you mentioned. Then he, he goes to a dinner party with some expat, academics like himself, and actually Fishman is at the party, and he you know, kind of, embarrasses himself and, you know, yells at Fishman, demands what Fishman has done for Russia, but, in a kind of, you know, Dostoevskian way, and Fishman just kind of laughs it off, and Andre has to leave in disgrace. But then subsequently there's this, you know, young woman there who, writes to him and named Yulia, who says, you know, do you want to come to this event we're doing at a bookstore, and talk about, you know, American neoliberal education? And so this kind of embarrassing incident, involving Fishman actually leads Andre, to meet this, group of young people called October, that is, kind of trying to rejuvenate socialism, in Russia. And, he really is taken with them, in part because, they sort of explain to him, or they make, you know, their ideas kind of clarify for him, the fate of his grandmother, who really has been left behind by the post-Soviet reforms. And, you know, this kind of, he hadn't had a kind of a intellectual, framework for understanding, what had happened to her, you know, outside of just her individual story, but, kind of these young Marxists, sort of, explain it to him, and he thinks they're right. So he joins October, and then of course adventures, ensue.
What does Andre learn about Russia being a repressive government?
Well, the people of October would say, you know, he expects, I mean, so the initial shock, of Andre when he arrives, and, you know, this is very much based on kind of my own experiences of visiting Russia over the years, is it's a very different repressive government from the one he expected. You know, this is, a country that resembles, it looks less like the Soviet Union than it does like Saudi Arabia, right? Or, Turkey, or a kind of, Latin American dictatorship, right, in the 70s. Mm-hmm. So its problems do not stem from an excess of socialism, but actually an excess of kind of unequally distributed wealth, right? And in a situation of unequally distributed wealth, in order to keep people from, you know, going on strike, talking out loud about how dissatisfied they are with the situation, you resort to repression. So as one of the characters says in the book, I mean, this is not what a socialist state looks like. This is what a capitalist state looks like on the periphery of the world system. So,
He talks about a lot about it being a repressive government. Another thing he talks about a lot is hockey. And while he's having all these terrible weaknesses and not getting through to anyone, he's also found a couple of hockey games, but he's playing really badly. That was pretty funny. A lot of fun games.
Yeah, well, I am a hockey fanatic. In the book, I mean, I felt like Andre needed something to do, but it also kind of put him in touch with a slightly different group of people. These are the hockey guys, right? I mean, so Andre comes from a kind of academic background. His kind of acquaintances are sort of expat academics or journalists. His grandmother comes from this kind of Moscow intelligentsia milieu, whereas the hockey guys are just kind of like business guys. Some of them work in finance, some of them are just kind of own businesses. And they form the kind of, pro-Putin middle class. They actually don't like Putin on a personal level, but they tolerate him. They have done very well kind of under the post-Soviet system through their kind of resourcefulness, their aggressiveness. But it puts Andre in touch with a kind of different group of people who I hope make the book kind of more lively.
I was amused. Yeah. It did. And I was amused that when he joins the reading group, his total lack of knowledge about Marx and Marxism was chalked up to a general American ignorance of everything.
Yes. Well, Russians think Americans are dumb. As a rule, yeah, I encountered this more in the kind of early 90s, mid 90s, and you would go over there and people would demand to know, you know, which books you had read, and part of it was that Russians had read a lot of books, right? I mean, it was a very literary or kind of logocentric culture, right? There weren't a lot of other kind of entertainments. So people did really read a lot. There was also, I think there was also kind of an issue of they had a slightly narrower idea of the canon than we did in the States. So I remember one of my relatives being scandalized upon meeting an American academic who studied Russian literature but had never read Dostoevsky. It is a little weird how we do that. Like, I mean, it's actually kind of hard to imagine that, but you can see how that could happen, you know, given just the way that, in academic life, you really specialize a lot in the U.S. And you become a really kind of narrow expert on
Chekhov.
Right. Yeah, Chekhov. Right. And you have these kind of blind spots, right? But within, but the reason, of course, Andre is feels like he's getting away with something there is that actually, you know, if you were a grad student in the, you know, the aughts, as he was, like the late 90s, you know, early aughts, in fact, there was a ton of Marxism and, you know, certainly in kind of your, you know, Ivy League or, you know, kind of urban universities and in the U.S. And, you know, the only reason Andre has managed to remain ignorant of it is that he's in the Slavic department, which kind of, you know, has traditionally kept those things, has kept kind of Marxism at a bit more arm's length than, say, the English department or the French department or even the German department, you know, largely because of the experience of communism, also because they were staffed by people who, you know, came out of that experience and, you know, weren't that interested in Marxism.
Mm. He's fluent in Russian as you are, but he constantly worries about making mistakes, which he then does. Mm-hmm. And he worries always about specifically about how to address people, which is in some languages, it's clear. So I felt like the role of language is almost like another character. He talks about it incessantly. Is that how you felt too, or where that?
Yeah, I mean, sure. I did. You know, my part of it was So you know, in Russian, there's the polite form of you, ты, and there's the familiar form of you, which is ты, and the polite form, which is вы. Right. So, your friends, your family, you say ты, you know, people that you just kind of encounter on the street or who are kind of older, or need to be addressed respectfully, you say вы. And that, you know, has changed a great deal, you know, even kind of in the last 20 years. Andre kind of, and I also, you know, aren't really, don't really know how to navigate that. Like, so, you know, I growing up, my parents basically said we to everyone, right? Mm-hmm. They were very, you know, even, I mean, so they're close friends, they said they, but everybody else was we, right? And that was a kind of mark of their being kind of, you know, from the intelligentsia, right? You know, there are people, I think, in, you know, in Imperial Russia, if you were from like an aristocratic family, you would say "vy" to your father, right? To your parents. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, so anyway, and yeah, so that kind of, that has changed a great deal by the time Andre shows up. But he's not sure. And this kind of marks him off as foreign more than, his accent, which basically doesn't exist. And you know, but and he's constantly kind of, it's a weird, yeah, he feels in between. If he was just an American there and he just had an accent, then, you know, that was fine because he's an American. But he's this person who basically speaks Russian in a way that's indistinguishable. And yet here and there he'll, you know, do the ending of a word wrong or kind of stress, put a stress on the wrong syllable. And it kind of gives him away as being, not from around here. And he remains worried about that kind of, almost till the end. But then as he kind of becomes more comfortable, in Russia, he stops worrying about it so much.
You know, Keith, I loved your book. It was a wonderful read. I learned a lot and I laughed and there was just, there was a lot to it. It's a rich, wonderful book. And I've taken up a lot of your time, so I'm going to now ask you the traditional new books question. What are you working on now?
Oh, man. You know, you're supposed to have a new book that you're working on when your old book comes out. That's the advice that wise people have given me, but I've never managed to do it. I can't figure it out. I am still trying to figure out what my next book is. I've been very wrapped up in, you know, talking about this one.
But you're teaching.
I am. I teach journalism. Yep.
You still have your magazine, your online journal.
Yes, I still, you know, I'm a little less involved with N plus one, which is also a print journal, both print and online. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we just had our second kid a few months ago, our second boy. So thank you. A lot of I'm trying to be helpful around the house. And yeah, so but I'm still looking around for my next project. But you know, that's about it. Took me about a year after my a year and a half after my book, my first book came out to start working on this one. So,
well, thank you so much. Thank you for sharing your time with me, Keith. It has been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to this podcast from the New Books Network. Once again, I'm G.P. Gottlieb, host of New Books in Literature, and today I've been talking with Keith Gessen about his novel, A Terrible Country. Join the New Books